All right, well.
Just have Shuming screaming in the background.
Yeah, into his crappy microphone.
Yes. Perfect.
Okay, we should probably say hi. Okay. All right. Here we go.
Hi.
Alright, welcome to Card Knock Life. This is episode 4. And to keep with the theme of 4 this week, we now have 4 Caballeros, Quattro Caballeros here. And I'm your host, Corey Murphy, along with your host, Brandy No Fetch Brainstorm Semerow.
Howdy.
John Red Deck Wins Galley.
What up?
And Daryl Glit. Feltner.
Whoa.
Wow.
That's for
that escalated.
Glittering Witch Control.
That's not getting it done.
You know what I'll do? You know what I'll do is I'll put a beep. I'll put a beep right over that word.
Yeah.
Thanks,
but that
guys.
Was just short. That was short for control.
I think you just need to put Biz Markie going on. Oh snap!
I'll work that in. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Anyways. We are here to talk a lot of Pro Tour today and a couple of news topics as well as... Oh, and Modern States happened last weekend as well. We got a couple discussion sections and a juicy deck tech from John, which is very red. And we'll begin a new leg day segment. So we will get started with the Pro Tour, of course. There's a lot to talk about here. I don't know about you guys. I watched a lot of coverage. Most of it was on in the background of what I was doing on Saturday, but... it was definitely running. Did you all get a chance to see that?
I got a chance to draft, so I had to miss.
I watched like half a dozen rounds. It was the decks were very interesting.
They weren't or were?
They were. Like, it's a standard format. Like, I don't like standard, and this is a standard format that I went, you know, I'll belly up to the bar, and I'll take a couple rounds here. I'll play this format, so.
I hooked you up with a little deck there at FNM on Friday.
Right,
yeah,
it's I would agree that it was very interesting. There's like a lot of new innovative stuff going on, and I think the format's definitely changed now after this Pro Tour. I think those blue black dragon decks are here to stay. I don't know what you guys think. Maybe that's something we can discuss a little bit as we dig in.
Yeah, I'm a little sad by the lack of Dragon Lord's Prerogative.
Yeah, hey, there were some though. They're in the sideboards.
Yeah, still not enough to make my stack 100 increase in any value.
True. No. Although, did you see the Adrian Sullivan man was representing with it in that top 4?
Absolutely, dragonless yet.
Yeah.
Was it in the dragons list too? The Shouta list.
He had one in the sideboard.
Okay.
Just one. But he needs like 3 more in the sideboard, maybe 3 more main deck.
It's a good card, but it's opportunity. I mean, that didn't see a ton of play, but it is relevant that it can't be countered.
So it is. It's 4 cards versus 3 cards. It's 1 mana more than Jace's Ingenuity. Both are instants. This one can't be countered. I don't know. It's a close call, right? Like by the time you're casting Jace's Ingenuity in this deck gets like an insane amount of mana out. But yeah, I think it's probably right to be running Jace's Ingenuity over Dragonlord's Prerogative. Sorry, Brandy.
Yeah, I apologize to my wallet.
I mean, there will be a day that Jace's Ingenuity will rotate. And that will be a very good day for Raven's Wallet.
So, wait, you said you apologized to your wallet. Did you actually go in on these? Do you have, like, 150 of them sitting on your desk right now?
No, I just have 20. That's my magic 20. Number. It's 5 play sets.
Hey, Brandy, you could be a lucky man. You might win yourself $20 on all those. One day. Hey, all right, anyway, so the deck that won was the Gruul Deck Wins, and that was Martin Dang. This is... like, I think we talked about this on the cast earlier. This was kind of basically that red deck that splashes green for Atarka's Command. I didn't see a lot of this one on camera. Have you guys had a chance to check this out?
I actually played it at a PPTQ 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
It's pretty good. I mean, I don't know. I've seen some articles about, like, the stats from the Pro Tour, and Mono Red was basically the borderline average deck. So, I mean, as much as he punched through and, you know, got some favorable draws, favorable matchups, I still don't think it's, like, anything special. I like the Atarka Splash just because it gives you some trumps in the mirror and gives you some weapons against Siege Rhino. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't think this list is doing anything special. I just think it did what Red Deck Wins does sometimes in the top eight, and he got there.
That is Lux out.
Yeah. I mean, he's won, like, the guy, like, he's won a Grand Prix before. Like, he knows what he's doing and stuff. Like, he's not a newbie player or anything. And, okay. Like, you know, if I don't know if – did you guys watch some of the top eight?
I didn't see a whole lot of the top eight.
So, like, his opponents were, you know, like, he's playing against, I think it was Abzan or something like that. And his opponents just play, like, tap land turn one, tap land turn two. And it's like, well, you're dead. I mean, if you get openers like that, you know, you're probably going to win most of those games.
Yeah. Well, obviously,
there's one interesting card I see, the Become Immense.
Yeah, that's odd in there, isn't it? It's cool.
It's cool. I've seen it in some lists, but it's definitely spicy in, like, a more of a mono-red aggro list like this. Usually it's in, like, a little bit of a bigger red-green list. He actually did, like, just totally dome some people to death with that, too, during the top eight.
Yeah, man, I really don't like that kind of card. It's like, I mean, you can functionally cast it for one mana pretty reliably when it's going to be, you know, like, just the surprise kill. And six power is, like, it's crazy.
You said you don't like it or do?
I don't like the fact that it exists. I don't like having to, like, poop my pants all the time thinking I'm going to get become immense and die. And, like, with Infect around, it's even worse, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy in that Infect deck. I mean, I love the card. I wrote a whole article about it, but I think it's insane. But, yeah, I agree with you. You don't want to be on the other side of it.
It kind of reminds me of the standard when we had Silverblade Paladin and people were, like, playing those, like, aggro decks where it's just, like, resolve Silverblade Paladin, beat in for a ridiculous amount of double damage, and it's, like, I don't know, it's just kind of that sort of brainless, like, if you don't have an answer right now, you're dead. Not to say that this card is as oppressive and as, you know, frequently, like, played main deck as Silverblade Paladin was at the time.
Sure. I like to look at these sorts of decks and just see, you know, how did they come up with these numbers, you know? Like, one Frenzied Goblin, did we just need, like, one You Can't Block effect, one Lightning Berserker... the one Become Immense makes sense, but, like, two Goblin Rabble Master. Like, we want to draw that card, but not too often, except for when we want to board the other two in. Like, I don't know. When I look at these Pro Tour winning decks, I just like to see how they, like, get to the strange numbers they get to. Like, why a Goblin Heel Cutter in the sideboard and not another Frenzied Goblin?
So
stuff like that.
At least for this list, I think I can break this down a little bit because I actually had some of those same numbers. But I don't know about the other lists, but... the Rabble Master, you really don't want a lot of in this deck because typically you're doing most of your work before your 3-drop is relevant. And usually he's something that's going to die right away, but that's less of a thing in this deck. It's more so just that he's an expensive card that doesn't have a high impact in this deck. And the Frenzy Goblin is, at least I ran a 1-of for a while, and it was more that, like, I didn't want to run a fourth Heel Cutter or a third Rabble Master, but I wanted that kind of effect in my deck. And he's super bad in multiples. Like, you never want to draw two 1-1s for one. That just doesn't do anything in this deck. Like, every other 1-drop in this deck can have the potential to get above 1 power and can have the potential to impact the game late. So it's certainly a card that... I don't mind having as a 1-of because it's really important in the mid-range matchups, but it's not something that I want to have more than that. The 1-of Heel Cutter and the board and the 2-of Rabble Master, like, I don't know about those numbers because personally I think Heel Cutter is one of the best cards in this deck. But, you know, I think he just wanted to go for more permanent value, keep putting the pressure on, that sort of thing, rather than just trying to auto-kill them on turn 4 or 5.
Yeah, but I would agree with Daryl. These numbers seem random to me, but this is certainly not my area of expertise. I think the weirdest one is the Lightning Berserker, the 1-of Lightning Berserker. But I guess that's kind of like that. It's kind of like running like 1-of Dragon's Claw in there too. You know, like you can kind of just blow them out with that, right?
I think the Berserker is just a contested spot. You'll see in the Pro Tour list, but also just in general, a lot of lists will run either 4 of that card or 1-of it or 2 or 3. Like people just can't decide what they think of the card. I personally, like, it was my favorite card of Dragon's Tarkir. I think it's really good. When you draw, like, when you include 3 or 4 in your list and you draw multiples, it can be pretty bad some games just because you can't invest all the mana you want into it. But it's certainly one of the best cards against control, and it usually is just a Doomblade to any creature that's in play.
Okay.
So, like, I'm fine with 1-of because it's such a utilized creature that, you know, you'll never be bummed drawing it.
Cool. So, of course, he beat the blue-black control dragon list that Shota Yasuka was piloting, and that is 1-of 3 of these, like, blue-black control decks in the top 8. The other one had had splashed white for Dragon Lord Ojutai too. So I'm not really sure which one of those is going to be like, you know, more prevalent in the meta. But I've been trying this blue black one on Cockatrice, and it's not really my type of deck. So it's kind of like I'm doing a little leg day here, and I think we'll talk about that later too. But this is like, man, every time I play this deck, I feel so dirty. Like, this is the exact same thing I hate to, like, go up against. It just has so many answers, and it's so much, like, draw-go.
Are you talking about Yusuka's deck?
Yeah, Yusuka's deck, the blue-black.
The dragons. So,
I really like what Yasuka's doing here. The Opulent Palace seems a little out of place because you're not actually splashing in a green card. It's just sort of like, there is, ooh, hey, I need some more dual lands. I ran out of Temple of Deceits and Dismal Backwaters. So, dealer, I need two more dual lands. But, like, Iceball Regent is just a better Dungeon Geist, and that's a really big boon to this deck. Just being able to have, you know, a guy that you can play in the mid-game. After your opponent plays Siege Rhino, you can go, all right, Iceball Regent, ice it down. And have a 4-3 to go over the top of whatever your opponent's doing. And then you tax them a little bit, and so... between Silumgar Scorn and Dissolve, you have enough protection for your creatures. I really like kind of the direction of the deck. I think that the Haven of the Spirit Dragon count is a little low. I think just one Ugin, like, I think that's the trump in a lot of these, like, big mana or control deck mirrors, is, like, who can play their Ugin and back it up with cheap counter magic? And so only having one and a one Haven sort of takes you away from the boost you can get in your control deck, in your control mirrors. Like, between that card and Pearl Lake Ancient, those are sort of the two cards that'll win those control mirrors. So the one Ugin, no Pearl Lake Ancient as the top end seems sort of strange, but it looks like he's just like leaning on a Dragonlord Silumgar to play Silumgar, take your opponent's Ugin, upstairs them with it, or ultimate it, or whatever you want to do with their Ugin. And sort of abuse their Ugin and use the one Haven to rebuy Dragonlord Silumgar if they kill it.
I think also, like, you have to make the choice if you're going to go Dragon heavy, you have to kind of theme that deck like that. I mean, I don't think he can include more finishers if he's going to have Icefall Regent and Silumgar and all that sort of stuff in there. There's just not room for it.
Yeah. Well, right. That's why I don't like another Ugin necessarily, but I do like another Haven.
Well, Daryl, the mana base is super tight. There's a lot of double-costed, like, actually almost every spell has double-costed mana on it, doesn't it?
Yeah, all the Jace's and Trudy's, Wild Blades. Yeah.
The Scorn definitely makes you have to have, like, hard blue early on, too. I thought that was interesting choice, too, because you'll see, like, Adrian's list is really streamlined. Like, he's got four Downfall, four Bile Blight. Like, he basically knows the important cards that he wants to see. And Yusuka here is just basically like, well, I've got Dig Through Time and other draw spells, so I'm just going to try to hit the, you know, card I need when I need it. I don't know which one's better here, though. It's kind of hard to decide, it seems like.
This guy leans more towards the control route. And to be honest with you, like, the dragons, I like the aspect of having those proactive routes to, you know, to play down the dragons and start attacking. But it's like, it's almost like those are like some of the worst cards in the deck. Like, Dragonlord Silumgar, having tested this, I almost never cast that guy. There are very few situations where I want to be tapping out six mana to play a guy that's going to eat the removal that they've been holding in their hand all game.
So do you like the Drifting Death version better? He has Hexproof.
Yeah, I think the Drifting Death version is way better. I would actually go up to, like, maybe two of those, or even I was thinking of taking out some of the Dragonlord Silumgars and putting in, like, I don't know, a Liliana Vest or something along those lines, where you've got, I don't know, like, some more, like, difficult to answer threat.
So you have one problem if you do that, is that your Silumgar Scorns go from Counterspell to Force Spike. And while Force Spike is very good against, like, Devotion, like, the third place list, or Drool Dragons, really
early. Mid-range.
Yeah, the mid-range decks very early when they're trying to, like, cobble together early Siege Rhino and early Tassinger and things like that. When your opponent is, like, turn 10, and you guys just are staring at each other with a bunch of lands, and they cast a spell, and you're like, I have a Force Spike. Ah, not helpful.
Right. No, I get that. I get that.
He's already super low on the dragon count, too, for running the Scorn like he is, because I think I mentioned this in one of the other podcasts, but, like, Karsten put the numbers together, and you had to have, like, eight or nine dragons to reliably use it in that manner. and he's only got six here, so I could see this even being a four spike a lot of the time in this list.
Well, with the draw spells, you get him pretty consistent. Sorry.
Yeah, he doesn't have the anticipate to dig for his dragons either.
Right, right, right. That's another thought.
So it's either you get lucky in the early game, or it's just going to be a four spike most of the time, and then late game it'll probably be active all the time with all the draw, but he's definitely not guaranteeing it being a counterspell early.
Okay. All right, well, in contrast to that, Adrian's deck is just totally dragonless, which is pretty sweet. This is pretty close to the old Pearl-like Ancient build, but of course there's no Pearl-like Ancient in this one. I kind of like the Perilous Vaults in there. I think those are pretty sweet. But having two Ugin is the biggest selling point of this one. I think this is kind of more the route that I would want to go playing control.
So, like, this is actually an interesting deck. And a lot of new control players will flounder with this deck just based on the way it's built. Not because it's a bad deck, but because there's only four finishers. You can consider Liliana as a finisher because most decks in Standard will have creatures. But there's only four or five finishers. So you have to be very careful of getting yourself into a position where you have a Perilous Vault in play, and then you play an Ugin, or play an Ashiok, and you have to vault because they can put enough pressure on the board that your Ashiok, you know, it's not worth keeping the Ashiok because you'll lose the game. So you have, like, a lot of new control players will kind of flounder with this at first. There's no backups for your Ugins and Haven of the Spirit Dragon. So it's just like, you have to be very careful with how you're playing things. You have to be, you know, understand this is, you know, where my opponent can do things and make sure that you hold up your counter magic to protect the right things and counter the right spells. And so you have to play very delicately. And the sideboard definitely shows that too, is that, you know, we have a couple extra, you know, win conditions for the control matchup with a Tassiger, a Pearl-like Ancient, a Cranial Archive. Mm-hmm. But again, we're not really trying to win the game. We're just trying not to die.
Right. This is dangerously close to those decks that had the Nephalia Drown Yard as the only win condition. It was like just all control. It was all answers. Those are so asinine to play against. It was like you go to time over and over again.
Well, it's really interesting because not only does he not have a lot of threats, he doesn't have a lot of way to protect his threats from just like removal, like, you know, the Ashiok and that sort of thing. Like, he has all these dead cards against control mirrors. And he has all these expensive cards as well. Like, it just seems like game one, he'd be a real big dog to another control deck. But I don't know. I mean, Adrian knows how to play those matchups, like you said, Daryl, like, you know, knowing how to pilot this thing well. But even piloting this well, it just looks so overcosted compared to some of the other lists.
By the way, we should add that this is the third/fourth place finisher, Adrian Sullivan's deck. Hey, Brandy, he's got your Dragon Lord's Prerogative in here with no dragons.
Yeah, he has one main deck in the control dragon deck, and Shouta's didn't have any. Even.
Zero, yeah, I just didn't need that card. That card is not necessary.
One other thing I was just going to say is that in his match that he lost against Mono Red, he boarded in the Interpret the Signs. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, I was questioning that too. It seems like Dig Through Time is just better, isn't it? But
I mean, they just
the delve that you're.
Okay,
yeah, so it's like, a six mana card. I mean,
you have like Dragon Lord's Prerogative is probably just strictly worse than Interpret the Signs in that matchup because you do like scry three, draw seven. Yeah, like when you're trying to close the game, scry three, draw, you know, four. What is it? Four for Perilous Vault, eight for Ugin, eight for Dig Through Time. Like, I feel like that's an easy one-for-one swap, and I think that's kind of what happened there, was he cut the Dragon Lord's Prerogative and boarded in the single Interpret the Signs. But
I mean, it's potential that you just, you wanted to make sure you try to hit the card you need, although it did end up boning him in that match, because that was when he lost game two. He went for it, and he had Ultimate Price. So he drew two cards and lost.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean,
but I see your logic, too. But, I mean, it just seems like such a gamble card. I got to feel like there's something else here that he could bring in and just not, you know, like still cut the prerogative, and there's got to be other stuff that he can bring in here.
Well, you also need a critical mass of card draw. Because, like, the problem with these, like, blue-black control decks is you have to play so many more lands because you're trying to win with a bigger spell. So he has to play 27 lands, which is, like, his red deck wins opponent played 20. So you have already, you're starting with seven more blanks than your opponent.
Sure.
So over the course of the game, if you play your game plan out, you're going to draw more blanks. So you need to draw overall more cards to get through all the blanks. So you still have to keep your large card draw spell count high enough that you can ignore running into the blanks. And by cutting a Dragon Lord's prerogative, that probably makes Adrian go, I'm not too comfortable with going under the, you know, X number of card draw spells I want in my deck to be able to beat, to be able to keep up with the extra blanks I'll draw from my lands.
All right.
That makes sense.
All right, so rounding up the top eight, then there are a couple of Abzan decks. There's Abzan Control in 5th/8th. Another Gruul deck in 3rd/4th. And we're also going to miss, Gruul Dragons in 5th/8th. So a lot of the same kind of, what do you call that guy? Thunderbreak Regent. A lot of him. And Atarka has now, you know, shown his ugly face and is like $20 sold out on a lot of websites. I don't know what it is right now, but actually, just about all the Dragon Lords have gone up quite a bit after the Pro Tour. Silumgar got played a lot. Atarka got played a lot. Ojutai is in the UBW Control Dragon in 5th/8th as well.
Yeah, I don't really like that version of the deck. Mostly because I don't like splashing white for just two cards. You're not bringing anything else into the mix. And you're just, like, manipulating your mana base in a crazy way. You're adding, you know, extra tap lands. And it may just be that, you know, you were going to play this many scry lands anyways, so why not make them all white so you can play this hexproof dragon that gives you extra card advantage? But it seems kind of awkward for your mana, depending on, like, I think it makes you play less like double black cards. Like, this deck, I don't think it has one Bile Blight instead of, you know, Adrian's deck got to play 4. Shouts has got to play, what, like 3, I think. Bile Blight got to play 3. And that's a super powerful card against these aggressive decks because you'll eat their tokens, or you'll if they come out with like the same, like two of the same guy, you get to eat two guys. You get a 2-for-1. And a lot, the blue black white dragon deck didn't get to leverage that same help from Bile Blight. So I think this is like a deck that's looking forward to get past Theros instead of a deck that's like using all the tools that are available to it.
And this guy's up to 4 anticipates main deck to kind of smooth out his draws too, I assume.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. So that's the top 8. There are a few decks if you click, I'm going to have a link up there in the show notes from MTG Top 8. You can click on the bottom, plus 35 other decks, and see a lot of the other like higher finishers in the standard portion of the Pro Tour. And one of them that showed up on camera that was pretty cool is the Chromanticore deck. And this is, help me with this name, guys, is Zvi Malshevitz.
Zvi Malshevitz.
Okay, and he's a member of the Pantheon, which is like the Channel Fireball team. It was actually Jamie Park who played on camera with this deck, but Zvi basically created this Chromantiflare deck to, you know, obviously abuse Soulflare. The best thing you can do with Soulflare is exile the Chromanticore, exile a Sylvan Caryatid, have a hexproof flying lifelink, trample, first strike, vigilance. Did I miss anything?
You did. You missed sneaking a god in there for indestructible.
And that was a big deal. Yeah. We've had a guy locally who's been having a lot of success with this deck prior to the Pro Tour. And one of the things that's real different about this list is that Farika, because giving your dude indestructible and hexproof, that's pretty much GG, I'd imagine, in any game of Magic.
Yeah, it leaves you down to one card or two cards that you're seeing playing standard right now that can deal with that card, and that's Foul Tongued Invocation and Crackling Doom.
Right.
Also,
before we go too far, though, let's just introduce this deck, because this is basically a Sultai Whip deck minus the Whip, and then they're splashing into you know, the extra two colors for the Chromanticore. You can hard cast them with the lands that they have available and 4 Caryatids. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was just going to say that also one of the cards that's in this list, it seemed to be like the breakout card of the Pro Tour, and I noticed its price spiked a bunch too, is that Den Protector.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys think about that card, but it seems really powerful after watching it on camera this weekend.
Yeah, it showed up a lot.
So if you've ever played with Eternal Witness, you know this card is powerful. And if you've ever played with Eternal Witness and then tack on a Can't Be Blocked clause to it, then you know this card is insane. So I think that, like, because, like, I watched a control player just lose because a guy went, oh, I have a Den Protector in my graveyard. I'll Megamorph this Den Protector and pick up my Den Protector. Attack you for three. Oh, you Doombladed. All right, I'll morph this Den Protector. Go. Oh, you can kill it? I'll Megamorph it. And just keep just cycling the same two Den Protectors, which is what you do in Fifth Dawn Standard when the control decks were viable when they banned Affinity. You would just play Eternal Witness and pick up Eternal Witness. And your opponent could never beat that because they would just have to waste all their removal spells on a 2-1.
You could put the Velociraptor in the mix, too, and then you've got some more recursion.
Oh yes, the Velociraptor is, makes it definitely more annoying. But Den Protector by itself is usually good enough to grind out the control decks.
Do you think that Raptor is a sneak preview for Jurassic World?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's sponsored by Jurassic Park. But you notice it's a lizard beast, though? I was kind of pissed about the flavor of this card at first because I thought it was a dinosaur, and it's like dinosaurs are supposed to be like the king of like the jungle or king of, you know, the earth when they roamed, and there's only one in all of Tarkir.
So yeah, I don't think lizards wants to put the dinosaur creature type.
Have they though? Allosaurus rider.
A buddy of mine was playing a Deathmiss Raptor deck this weekend, and his name for the deck was Clever Girl. I thought that was pretty good. I don't know.
You're going to have to explain that one to me. I don't get it.
Oh, because that's what what's the dude's name? Like Murdoch or something? The guy from Jurassic Park.
Uh-huh.
When the raptor sneaks up on him, he's like, Clever Girl, and then he gets eaten. Yeah. Oh. You got to go rewatch Jurassic Park, Daryl.
So anyway, it's been 10 years, man.
So the other thing with Den Protector real quick, too. Yeah. So I saw people like end of turn Boonsader Bestow on this guy. He just seems absurd with that mode. Like, I don't see anybody blocking him at that point. There's like a mono green deck that was going crazy with it. And apparently, like, if you have two Den Protectors, and I think, I don't know if it's one other card, there's an infinite combo with him, too.
What?
Like, yeah, because, like, you can keep, like, each Den Protector returns each other to play or to your hand or what have you. And then there's, like, some kind of infinite combo. I think it's, like, there's one other card, but I think one of these green decks had it in there, too.
Hmm.
So he just seems like bananas across the board.
Comment that kept coming up for him was he can beat through the Elspeth tokens. So all those chump blockers, he just, he just passes right through them. It's pretty sweet. So I don't know. What is this card up to now? He's got to be, like, up in price at this point.
Let's see what the old Channel Fireball has on that.
Check it out. While you're looking at that, this deck runs four Commune with the Gods, which is not in the Sultai Whip deck so much anymore, but is, like, beautiful in this deck. This is the reveal top five, put a creature enchantment into your hand. So you look at the top five and grab one of the five Soul Flayers. This is, like, turn two. Wow,
five Soul Flayers?
So naturally when you Commune with the Gods, then all five of the cards are Soul Flayers.
Yeah.
No, you grab one of your four Soul Flayers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then turn three, you've got your Soul Flayer with the Chromanticore-like costume, which I did that on Cockatrice today, and I was like, oh, man, no one's beating me now. I had exiled the Chromanticore and a Caryatid on turn three when I commune with Gods on turn two. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, I'm beating in for four, Vigilance, Hexproof every turn, and then Jeskai Charm. Oh, no, what was it? It couldn't have been Jeskai Charm. I guess he wasn't Hexproof. He was indestructible. So Jeskai Charm put him on top of my deck, and it was like, that was the end of that, because there were no creatures left in my yard. Yep. And then it's not so good to have a 4-4.
Little investigative journalism for you. There are no dinosaurs in Magic the Gathering.
Oh, thank you.
And Den Protector is $5, according to Star City.
Yeah, that seems like a good spec to me, too. I mean,
it was.
It's a breakout weekend for him. Card seems insane. Like, feel like it's more than $5.
Cool. All right. Should we talk news here? I guess the news for us specifically was the Modern States. A lot of you guys participated in that.
Do we have anyone who placed? Daryl, you played in it, right?
I did Standard States.
Okay. Either one.
I played Modern States. I did not top eight. I got, like, 15th or something on Breakers.
All that matters is that you had fun.
I did have quite a bit of fun. Yeah. I played the five-color control deck I've been playing. I updated the list a little bit. I'm going to have to renege on my podcast one statement that Narset is going to do nothing in any format ever, because I played that card in Modern on turn four about a dozen times that day, and every one of my opponents panicked. Like, I was like, Narset plus one. They're like, I don't know how I'm going to beat that card.
Seems like it's made for your deck, Daryl.
Yeah.
That rebound seems beautiful in there.
I locked out a Living End player with the ultimate, and forced him to cast a bunch of 6-mana 6/3s, which I promptly Lightning Helix to death, and killed him with, like, a Snapcaster. And I ultimated Narset against an Eggs player. That was quite fun.
What is Narset's ultimate?
Wait, did you say an Eggs player?
Yes. You get an emblem with your opponents can't cast non-creature spells.
Oh, okay. And what was that about Eggs?
I believe that's a deck that tries to play a lot of non-creature spells and then hits you with a Banefire, which is also a non-creature spell.
Okay, so this is not the Second Sunrise, which is
no, it's no that more. Deck.
No, Eggs got... So what happened was Pieces got banned. Okay. But then, like, Conley Woods came out with, like, Eggs 2.0, which wasn't very good, and no one ended up playing it. But apparently, you played against it.
Yeah. I played against it in the 3-0 bracket. He was a very competent pilot.
Did you want to end your life after that match? Or?
No, actually. I beat him in like 10 minutes game one, and then he started going off game two, and I like had him show me an infinite loop, and I scooped in 5 minutes, and then we played game three, in which I ultimated an Narset, and attacked him to death with the Siege Rhino.
Yeah. You know, there's some decks like that that, you, if you think about it, it's like you don't finish 90% of your games. Like, I think Tron is the same way. Like, once you resolve a Karn and they're like, well, I can't really do anything about this, you don't ever get to use your Karn. You just get to cast it.
You're telling me you've never sat through your opponent while they've Karn ultimated?
No.
No.
I haven't. Because I'm always playing, like, a stupid deck that just bends over to Karn, Karn and Tron.
I think last time I played against Karn, I went to the bathroom while my opponent was doing the Karn thing. I called the judge, and he restarted the game with a Wormcoil Engine. I was like, judge, could you shuffle this one way? I have to go to the bathroom, and I'm not going to win because my opponent has a Wormcoil Engine. And Daryl, the judge shuffled the deck for me, and we came back, and I died to a Wormcoil Engine 3 turns later.
Daryl, you already said this, but what deck did you play, Daryl? I have no idea what we're talking about.
I played sort of a 5-color control deck.
You did play your deck.
Yeah, I was developing from week one of the podcast. It underwent some more developments. We cut Rocks Warmonk for Siege Rhino in the sideboard, so we played 3 Siege Rhinos on our board.
It's inevitable.
Yeah, it was inevitable. I played a game against Merfolk where I wrathed his board and he had no cards in hand, and I was like, all right, Glittering Rush for Siege Rhino, play a Siege Rhino, attack you, play another Siege Rhino, attack you, Lightning Helix, you're dead. And it was just 3 turns of just wipe your hands and move on to the next game. Like,
you've got Supreme Verdict in there, huh?
Yeah, 4 okay. Supreme Verdicts total between the main side. 3 and 1 Wish for.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Well, I know that Daryl may not have placed well, but podcast friend Michael Finnegan ended up winning Modern States on Sunday. And I believe he won with that Amulet Bloom combo deck.
Correct. That's what he was playing.
And so I got to talk to him a little bit about it. He's going to come on tonight, but I think he's having too much fun playing with that Bling Dalion that he won. But
the Bling Dalion. He goes right in the whip, right?
Of it, he played a lot of Burn, so...
He did.
I guess Amulet combo is really good against Burn.
Yeah, kind of a turn or two faster. It's definitely, as a Burn player, not what I
want. So, it's also, if you've never had the joy of doing this, I watched him play against Burn trying to lock up winning in into 8th place, because he was the 8th seed when he played in that turn, that top 8, and he won it from the 8th seed. He's playing against Burn. He goes, turn 3, Primeval Titan, go get Radiant Fountain and Vesuva, make a Radiant Fountain, and then untapped and played another Summer Bloom, and he goes, bounce land, pick up my Radiant Fountain, Radiant Fountain,
yeah.
Bounce land, pick up my Radiant Fountain, Radiant Fountain, attack you, go get 2 Vesuvas, make 2 Radiant Fountains.
Daryl, you're giving me nightmares.
I felt very bad for the poor Burn opponent. And then, like, 3 turns later, he's, like, cast a Summoner's Pact and played Thragtusk.
Does Burn have Blood Moon inside?
Not usually. That's a bad card for Burn.
So, like, monocolored Burn has Blood Moon in the sideboard, but a lot of the Burn decks are 3-colored now, splashing for, like, Boros Charm and Atarkus Command or Destructive Revelry or whatever.
This is not Legacy. Nobody plays Monocolor Burn in Modern.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, no Blood Moons for our heroes, the Burn player.
Blood Moon, honestly, is like sometimes even good against Burn because of how greedy the mana base is right now. I mean, I wouldn't play it against Burn, but it is a card that sometimes can just wreck them. Like, they have Boros Charm and Atarkus Command, and then all of a sudden they just can't cast their hand.
Yeah, like I played against my Burn opponent in round four where I, like, took my first loss, and I cast Castigate because I was playing that card, which, for those of you who have never played it, is black-white. Look at target opponent's hand, exile a card from it.
Because it's gold.
Yeah, exactly. It was 2-mana Thoughtseize for no damage. And his hand was like Boros Charm, double Lightning Helix, Grim Lavamancer. And I was like, man, if my deck didn't suck with Blood Moon in it, this would be a great hand to Blood Moon my opponent.
Yeah, we'll call that hipster Thoughtseize.
No. I mean, it was Thoughtseize before Thoughtseize was cool.
Yeah.
But
that's a hipster, right?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Anyways, John, did you played at States as well, Standard?
Yep. I rolled with Mardu Midrange.
Oh, right.
I actually lent the deck to Daryl on Friday because I decided to do a draft. It had been a while. And he went 3-1 with it. So then I made a couple changes and rocked it. I went 5-2, and I think I would have done better, except my list had very few early removal spells because I was playing a tokens plan with the full Dragon Fodder package and Hordling Outburst and Goblin Rabble Master and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But very no Lightning Strike. And then I played Abzan Aggro 4 times over the course of the day. So, yeah, it was pretty tough. Fleece Mane Lion was definitely a card I was getting sick of seeing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, I beat him twice and lost to it twice and then beat just about everything else in the tournament. So,
Our Abzan deck is still pretty big in the Madison
standard. Have I played it 4 times? Yeah, I think it's pretty big still. I mean, a lot of the players that are decent around here still play Abzan and like it a lot. And I kind of expected it, but I just didn't think the matchup would be so tight. I was happy to see, just on a side note, that one of our Madison guys, McKinley, got second place. He's playing Red-Green Dragons, and I watched him run through the finals and whatnot, or run all the way up to the finals. And his list definitely seemed pretty sweet with, like, he decided to include Serac, and he still had the Coursers in there, so it kept it pretty aggressive.
Cool. I kind of figured, like, Abzan gets played so much, or it did, and I'm kind of thinking that it's about time where people get tired of that deck and they want to build something new. So I'm guessing that the next deck du jour is this Dragon Control deck. Everyone's going to put that together.
Well, I think it's easier as a control deck to play than the creatureless control decks, where the creatureless control decks, you're kind of just like sifting through your deck, finding answers, whereas the Abzan decks, they're a little more proactive. You know, you're dropping your Seed Rhinos, dropping your whips,
right?
And it gives you, just inherently by reanimating your graveyard, you have way more options as opposed to trying to find something to put into your hand to set up to play later.
I guess the Abzan control decks play out significantly differently than the Abzan aggro decks, even though they have a lot of similar cards in them.
Yeah. I mean, I see a lot of the Abzan players just moving to Seth Manfield's Atarka Abzan deck, where they're just put some Trilands in your deck and splash for Atarka, because, you know, if you're going to play in a world of Abzan midrange, what better way to be midrange than slamming an 8-8 flyer and killing their Siege Rhino? So,
I think one of the advantages to the Abzan aggro deck is that it's very fast, especially now with Serac. And, like, the Dirtly Abzans just get, you know, destroyed by cards like Ashiok, and you know, control can keep pace with them. Like, I think it definitely, the aggro version is at a premium here, is it a better position than the mid-range version would be because of that. Although, I don't know if you guys saw the numbers, but the control decks had, like, something like a 90% win rate on day one at the Pro Tour. So, wow. It seems to be a good deck to be on.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
I hope it's not, like, man, it's already all over Cockatrice. I'm getting really tired of seeing it. Not to say that Cockatrice is like any like consistent metagamer or anything, but
I will give you guys the big heads up for your standard tournaments if you're playing. You will probably get Ashiok ultimated at some point.
Okay.
Hope your opponent does not understand that if you had powerful cards in your hand that were exiled by Ashiok, they can also put them into play out from under Ashiok.
Power? What do you mean?
So when you ultimate Ashiok, it exiles your hand in graveyard. If there was like an Atarka in your hand,
right? They count for Ashiok.
Put the Atarka into play from the Ashiok because it's all cards exiled with this Ashiok. So if it doesn't die, it's still the same object, and the cards you exile from their hand are eligible targets for putting into play.
Okay.
So what you're saying is just play Torrent Elemental dot deck.
Yeah. Yes, perfect. We did it.
Oh man, I love Torrent Elemental. I've been trying the Sultai Whip deck, and that card's so awesome. The exile shenanigans on there go so well in there in that deck. All right, before we move on here, we don't have time to talk about it, but Durward posted a bees list, and I'm like, I don't know, I love this deck, so I'm gonna post this.
Talk about
it,
man. This is your baby, right?
Yeah, Corey, I heard you really do like bees.
I do. I really do.
Well then, let's CD bees nuts.
Okay. Well, there's not a whole lot to talk about. The deck is pretty similar to the deck tech that we ran like 2 weeks ago or whatever. But Dragonlord Atarka has of course shown up in this one, and Rofs, which according to this article that I'm gonna have in the show notes, I didn't even think of this, but he said something about how awesome it was to roast your own hornet nest and get 5 bees out of it. So that seems pretty sweet. He also has in the sideboard, he's got a couple of cool things in there. Minister of Pain in the sideboard. And if you look at the deck list, there's only like 1 mana confluence and 4 Caryatids that actually produce black mana. But you can flash that in with a Court of Calling and hit all the tokens that Jeskai can put out in the Secure the Waste tokens. It's pretty sweet. And what else? See, pretty straightforward sideboard. A little less on the Ashcloud Phoenix. There's 1 fewer Pelucranos in the deck, I think, now. And 1 fewer Courser of Kruphix to make room for the Rofs and the Atarka. Then also, Sam Black played this list at the Pro Tour. That'll also be in the show notes. And I think it's almost exactly the same thing. I don't have it pulled up right now, but I'll have them both there for you to compare if anyone else is interested in running this. I think it's a very competitive deck now. It's pretty awesome. So
yeah, he was also talking about like after roasting the Hornet's Nest, then Court of Calling with the Hornet Nest tokens. I thought that was pretty sick.
Yeah, it like everything in this deck just like fits like a puzzle. It's so great. Like all the different interactions with the Court of Calling and the Sedestin tactics, like before or after the Hornet's Nest goes off. Like obviously, Setessan tactic fighting your hornet nest into a big creature is great, but then also targeting all your bees and then fighting their creatures is great too after the fact. So,
I think this deck would have done easily a top 8 too if there hadn't been so much control. Not that control's unwinnable, but certainly one of the tougher matchups probably for this deck. And you know, Sam Black top 16 with it, but I mean, this deck's just like unstoppable when like you're playing against like Abzan or Red Deck or what have you. Like nobody can get through a Hornet's Nest very easily, let alone 4.
Yeah. That. Oh, Sam's got Scuttling Doom Engine on the board, and that came in on camera. That seemed pretty cool in there. But otherwise, yeah, pretty similar list. Arbor Colossus in the side. That's kind of old news for Caleb's list. All right, cool. We can go on then. We're kind of in the news segment now, but one last thing to cover in here. I kind of stumbled upon this on Reddit, and I wanted to know what you guys thought of this. Is the this deck rental service that has kind of recently been launched, I think. But let me just read this to you real quick. It's called Spare Deck, and you can get there by sparedeck.com. This is the post, and so this is their word. Spare Deck lets players rent MTG decks and singles for upcoming events through the mail. The focus is currently on standard decks. They don't have Modern and Legacy so much right now, but that's coming. Standard decks can be rented for around $20 and $40 for a weekend. So I'm not really sure what that means $40 for a weekend or $20 for a day, I see. And then you can adjust the rental period so it best fits your schedule and is even economical to rent a deck for an entire month if you desire. Now, of course, there's like a late fee. Like if you don't turn the deck in time, I think it's like 15% of the rental fee gets charged every day that you have it beyond that time. And I think you can rent singles as well. Let's see here on the FAQ. But basically, they show up unsleeved in a box, and then it's your job to put them back in the box and send them back to the site. In the amount of time that you have. So I don't know if it's necessarily something I would do, but I can see like if you're grinding some tournaments and you need a deck in a pinch and you want to have exactly the deck that you're going to be running, this seems like a fine option. I don't know. Is this something you guys would consider?
I think this option or this service benefits the renter more than the person who's getting the deck rather than the person who's lending out the deck. There was a time when I went to an SCG open at the beginning of summer, and I had to drive to Indianapolis. So basically, I didn't have a deck. So every Magic store I looked up on Google between where I live and Indy, and I basically stopped at everyone and bought my deck as I drove there. And that cost like $400. So I don't want to do that again. Yeah. So I would gladly pay $20 to rent that deck for a weekend because, you know, I'm never going to see the return on that. The issue I see is the person who wants their deck back after you borrowed it from them. If you give it back to them late, I mean, they might miss another FNM with it, or they might miss some sort of event they want to play throughout the week with it.
I don't think you don't rent it from a person. You rent it from the service. I think they have the inventory of cards that they assemble the deck and send it to you.
Right, yeah.
I'm actually on the website checking out the service, just trying to see what it is and, you know, check out what they're doing. And it's actually – this is something I definitely would have used. Because I got second in an Invitational back in October, but I've never went to an Invitational because I don't want to buy a standard deck. And I know a lot of people around here, but like trying to scrounge together the exact 75 cards I want, you know, may not be possible because I may not have a supplier that I could talk to that has every card. And if I want to like travel on a Thursday, you know, I'm going to make them miss FNM if they're going to play with those cards. So, like, it kind of creates a feel bad for the people I know that, you know, are trying to do that. It looks like they are a single location supplier because I've tried to rent two different decks already just by clicking on their add to cart service. And there's local pickup in Terre Haute, Indiana. This is one of those things that if you're going to Indianapolis to play an open, you could, you know, check the local pickup and return and save yourself the deck I currently have pulled up. You know, $750 in shipping, and pick it up on your way into Indianapolis, and then drop it off on your way out. And you know, if it's not too far out of your way, I'm pretty sure it's not. I'll have to take a look. Then you could do it there, but otherwise, you can just have it shipped to you. And so they basically just have every card listed card for card, just saying, you know, this card's 80 cents. You want four of them? You're going to pay $3.20 to borrow them from us for the.
They obviously are looking to expand. I mean, if they're considering Modern and Legacy, I think that's something that I would certainly consider doing. But holy cow, I mean, the rental fee's got to be more for a Legacy deck or a Modern deck, doesn't it?
Are they considering expanding?
They are. I'm sorry, actually, I was looking at this wrong. I accidentally didn't clear the cart. So this is $61 for two decks.
Damn it, Daryl.
Sorry, man. It's $30 a deck, and that's including shipping. Okay. So,
this seems like a really, really cool idea. I mean, it's something like for me, like, you know, I have a good friend base that I could borrow cards from if I'm missing a deck, but there's certainly a lot of people that just don't have that resource. And, like, especially if you're mostly like an MTGO player and you decide to go to a big tournament and you live in like a rural area or something, I could see this being pretty sweet. I'm kind of curious where they came up with the $20 and $40 of their prices because it just seems kind of random. Like, to me, that sounds expensive, but then for the person that's lending out the cards, the service, it seems kind of cheap.
Right, yeah, I agree.
It's hard to find the balance, I would think.
So how they do it is they basically do it per card. They put a tag on each card of saying this card costs you X amount of dollars to rent. For the time period.
Okay.
So are certain decks more expensive than others to rent?
Yeah, so it looks like they would be. Like right now I'm looking at a Todd Anderson Jeskai token set. And so if you want to borrow a Dragonlord Ojutai, the rental fee is $1.60. If you want a Goblin Rabblemaster, the rental fee is $1.20.
Oh yeah, I see what you're talking about here.
Elspeth Sun's Champion is $1. But like, if you look at other cards that aren't so, you know, aren't mythic rares, you know, Valorous Stance is a nickel, Treasure Cruise is a nickel, Stoke the Flames is 30 cents. So like, they just add up the 75 cards worth of value that they basically put as a tax onto the card, and say, you know, this is what it's worth as a rental because you're not going to own it; you're just going to use it for 3 days. No big deal.
So I think that that policy must have changed, because what I was reading was obviously not that way. But once you put the deck in your cart, then you can adjust the numbers on each one of those.
Yeah, you can.
Sorry, I wasn't more clear on this. I know I brought this up. I should have looked into it some more, but...
Certainly, you can. I was just saying, like, each... I just clicked the whole deck, because they just had, like, decks labeled on their front page. And so it shows that, you know, Dragon Lord Ojutai is $1.60. This deck has 3 Dragon Lord Ojutais. It'll cost you $4.80 for that card. And so it has the whole list of cards for the deck. So if you want to boot cards out and change the deck list, you can, and it'll show you the costs upon changing.
And they do have, like, I did the browse by set option. They have a lot of Legacy and Modern stuff on here, too. Like, they have Tabernacles and stuff like that. Obviously, the rental fee is, like, $25. But...
Oh, really? Yeah, wouldn't you be paranoid, too?
I mean,
the rented Tabernacle?
I don't think I'd be, I mean, maybe a little bit, but, man, I just wonder, like, somebody's investing this much for rental fees, like... I feel like the people this would apply to would be like, Daryl, like, you are a Legacy player and you play maybe one or two standard tournaments a year. So this would make more sense if you didn't have somebody to borrow from, or like, you know, somebody who just doesn't play Magic that much and may go to one or two big tournaments a year. But otherwise, like, wouldn't you just want to take this money and multiply it 4 times and build a deck?
I think it depends on your economics. I think for someone like me, where I don't live near anyone and I want to travel to an event, it's great. And I think there's a lot of people like that who live in these smaller communities and they don't have access to these cards. And they just want to go to like one or two big events.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, it's going to be cool to get into Modern and Legacy deck rentals in the future. And, like, could you imagine being able to play Vintage one day? That would be sweet if you can find a tournament rent a Vintage deck. But, of course, then you're coughing up a couple $100 to rent the deck in the first place. And I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you want to sell your deck later on, you know, how much money are you going to lose if you were to buy that deck and then resell it?
That is one thing, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So. All right, next up on the list, John has a deck tech for us. This is our juicy deck tech segment. We are working on a bumper theme song for this one, so stay tuned for that. Brandon had some kind of some sort of odd ideas for that one, so one day it'll surprise you. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah, this deck was designed by a buddy of mine that's on my other podcast. It's based around, well, the original list was based around Devastating Summons, which was a standard card in Mono Red for a while. And it lets you pay one red, sacrifice X lands, and get 2 XX creatures equal to the number of lands that you sacrificed. So you'd pair it, usually you'd hope to pair it with Goblin Bushwhacker, which was a one red goblin with one kicker that gave +1/+0 in haste to all your creatures. So you basically, you know, you tap 3 or 4 lands when you got to that point, float some mana, play the summons, play the Bushwhacker with kicker, and you'd have a bunch of giant hasty guys. And even if they had, like, a Path to Exile or a Doomblade or something like that, you'd still be left over probably with one big guy to finish the job. So his list, I'll just go over it real quick, was 3 Legion Loyalists, 3 Zergos, 4 Bushwhacker, 4 Goblin Guide, 4 Cackler, 4 Devil, 4 Eidolon, 3 Summons, 4 Brute Force, 4 Lightning Bolt, 4 Titan Strength, and 19 Mountain. Basically, you know, as aggressive mono-red as you can get with all the one-drop goblins and that sort of thing. And I was skeptical when I first saw the list. I've seen some kind of stuff like this in Modern before, but obviously with any kind of a brew in Modern, you wonder if it has the stuff to keep pace with things. But this is actually a little bit faster than Burn, so that matchup's really good. And it's pretty good against the field. My friend who designed it, he top four'd his TCG Modern States, and then he won his PPTQ this weekend with it. He changed a little bit. He added a Tarka's Command to the new list. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same thing.
Cool. Seems like a sweet deck. Lots of one drops.
Yeah, so I've played against the card Devastating Summons. That was sort of one of my standard wheelhouses when I played standard. That card's terrifying. Like, you can have 3 mana and a Path to Exile, and your opponent's just still going to go, yeah, Devastating Summons for 4. You don't have a counterspell? Nope. All right. Attack you for 10. You path a guy. You take 6. You're at, like, 4. And in that format, you could draw, like, Jace the Mind Sculptor to, like, play Jace, bounce your other token, and, like, fight your Goblin Bushwhacker, essentially, because you don't have any lands. But, like, this is not a format with, like, cheap interaction like that. Like, we have cheap interaction, but not great interaction for, like, 5/5s and 4/4s. The cheap interaction's like Bolt, where you're killing those X3s and X2s. So, you're not, there's not a lot of great things to interact with a 4/4.
Yeah, and this list, obviously being modern, is a little bit faster than that standard version was, so it's even scarier than that most of the time. Like, the only deck that I've really had trouble with, and he's had trouble with, is Tarmo Twin, when they have, like, Tarmogoyf and Huntmaster of the Fells, and just big roadblocks to get in your way are a lot of life gain, but that deck's not super popular, and other than that, it's been pretty good. And you also have some sweet plays with, like, Brute Force in here that... You know, it's one way to accelerate your win, but also if your opponent typically will try to go Lightning Bolt your dude, like, you know, Twin, that's like one of their main ways to interact with you. You'll just brute force in response, and they'll just get totally crushed at that point. So it's definitely got some sweet options. Now, I don't know about these 25 Tibalts in the sideboard, though.
Those are any of those, John, right?
I think somebody trolled you, sir.
Yeah, it looks, I don't know. Hey. I think that guy would lose the game for you pretty much.
I got a question for you, John. I don't know if this is something you've encountered with this deck before, but it seems like it would be a really sad day to cast Devastating Summons and have it remanded as the Sacrificing Lands is an additional cost. Now, obviously, you want to play around that, but, I mean...
Yeah, Summons, you pretty much just don't ever cast it if it's a liability. And, in fact, in his new list, he basically just cut Summons for Tarkas Command because they were similar roles, but the Tarkas Command was a little more reliable in this format. Okay. But, like, Summons is always like that. You basically play it on 3 or 4 lands if they're tapped out or if you have an opportunity for it. Otherwise, it just lets you sit in your hand. Because, yeah, that play would be awful.
Then you've got to change the name of the deck.
Well, actually, the deck has garnered a nickname over the weekend. Some of his opponents called it Scumbag Red. So that's the new name for the deck.
Scumbag Red? Really? Just because your opponent doesn't get to play Magic?
Just got a bunch of scumbags in your deck, yep.
So, John, what's the benefit of being a scumbag compared to a traditional mono red or red splash white black player in Modern?
Well, you know, while your opponents are going to time, you know, you're getting your lunch and taking a nice long walk on the beach, you know, and that's the advantage of being a scumbag in Magic.
Where are you playing Magic where there are beaches, yo?
Milwaukee.
GP Tampa? I don't know.
Jesus.
Beautiful shores of Lake Michigan. You can pick up some sewage while you're at it. Hey, there are 2 Smash to Smithereens in the sideboard. Chalice on 1 seems pretty bad.
Yeah, it's probably a little rough. I actually
let's take a look at this deck. Yeah, 4 cards we can cast, dealer. No, thank you.
I wanted to go up to a 3rd Smash. I noticed that in his new list, he didn't do that. He changed it to 1 Smash, 1 Shattering Spree. But, you know, Chalice, it's not as popular as it was when Delver was around. I mean, it was a big card when Treasure Cruise Delver was the thing. But I think people just kind of put it on the back burner again. I haven't seen it at all.
Right. So that one Shattering Spree doesn't solve the problem, though.
That does not. It makes it worse. Yeah. No, I mean, I think you just hope to dodge. I mean, I think
that's Shattering Spree actually does solve Chalice of the Void. This is something legacy players know very well, and not very many other people if you've not interacted with it before. So Shattering Spree replicates a trigger. Okay. So you cast Shattering Spree, replicate triggers. You can pay a red to shatter an artifact, cast another Shattering Spree.
Oh, and it's not the actual card.
Cast. It's not actually cast, it's just made by the trigger. So if you play Shattering Spree for R and replicate it twice to shatter 2 Chalice on ones, it counters the original Shattering Spree. But the 2 Jocelyn ones don't counter the 2 copies that would kill them.
Okay, while we're at it, I want to remind everyone, I talked about this last week, that you cannot Lightning Bolt a Tarmogoyf when there's a sorcery and a land in their graveyard, because the instant will make him bigger, and will cry.
I thought this was a competitive podcast.
Technically a legal maneuver, actually.
All right, I'm gonna say that next week, too, just for a couple more weeks so no one else has to deal with that. But,
technically a legal maneuver, but sure.
Hey, that's a good segue, though, right, Brandon?
Yeah, so I guess we're onto our Twitter at this point.
Yeah, I guess so. Is that how you're going to do this?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so I got the wonderful opportunity to explore the Winona, Minnesota Magic the Gathering scene this last week. And while I was in there talking to some of the local players, we were talking about our decks. And, you know, when you meet a new Magic player for the first time, usually you find yourself in a deck measuring competition over who's done the most in regards to playing the game. And so he started telling me about the last States event that he went to. And the gentleman had told me that he made it all the way up to semifinals. And that's when the bad beat story came in. And he told me his story about getting mana screwed. And so here at Card Knock Life, well, bad beat stories are $1. And I promptly asked him for $1. And, well, he kind of shrugged his shoulders and walked away after that. But this brings us to our competition. And it's not so much a competition as a way for you guys listening to interact with us. And so we are now offering to read anybody's submitted bad beat story for $1. And so what we're going to do is open up our PayPal stream, and you can donate $1. What's that?
For the good of the people.
For the good of the people. For the good of the people. This is everyone, for everyone to get their frustrations out, to get some good comedic content on air. And so you can send us $1 to our PayPal account. Currently, we're running off of my old college account. It's semro@wisc.edu. And what you can do is donate the $1 as a gift. And right in the gift description, you can write us your bad beat story. And it will be narrated by myself and any of our fellow podcasters that wish to chime in. And so this will be a great opportunity, and we're hoping to hear some of everybody's great bad beat stories, because we know they're all worth at least $1 to hear.
I feel like we need to do a voice for this bad beat, you know, like put an accent on it or something.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, we have the technology to do that.
So I guess I have two questions for the people, because those will come up. How long of a story, and will we just read every single story we get?
Daryl, let me answer your question with an example here. This is an example bad beat story. Once upon a time, all bad beat stories should start in the typical story format, by the way. Once upon a time, I worked really hard and got to the Pro Tour. And whilst I was playing in the Pro Tour, I don't know if that's the proper use of that word, or if it's a word, I shuffled my deck with my giant hands, keeping 7 cards in my palm while I did it. And the judge saw me, asked me to flip over my hand, gave me an immediate disqualification, and sent me home on a plane where I cried.
Oof, that's a great example.
Bad beat story.
And then they said, that's how he top-8ed Vancouver.
Oh.
Yeah, that guy's sketch.
Is that like what you had in mind, Brandon?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be about how you were bad beating your opponents all day with your palm cheats, or how you got DQ'd because of your palm cheats.
So,
dude, let's be real. That guy went to Vegas and became the next David Blaine. That's some serious, like, next level cheating shit.
Yeah, this is kind of like a basketball advantage. You know, like everyone that's tall, like, you know, it's just like science says. If you're tall, you're good at basketball, right? So if you've got big hands, you're good at magic now. I didn't know that was a thing. We learned from Dragons of Tarkir, if you're good at rolling a d20, you're good at magic too, because you can get all those promos. Anyways, that's that. Brandon, did you say your PayPal address on the air here?
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be in the show notes. It's semro@wisc.edu, semerau. @wisc.edu. So just gift us $1, leave that description filled with your bad beat story, and we'll narrate it in our best way that we can.
All right. Anyone got any good non-magic this week? Oh, boy. We played a lot of magic.
We played a lot of magic.
Come on. We all have.
I played a ton of lottery.
I'll tell you a story. This is a really sad story. This is my bad beat story that was non-magic. I came home from work on Friday, and I had recently started drinking beer again after Lent had passed. and I had one single beer on Friday night, and I ate dinner and drank water and all the stuff you're supposed to do when you drink beer, and I had a hangover the next day until 11 o'clock at night. I went to bed with a migraine headache, and I was, like, throwing up all day. Yeah, I don't know what's going on, man. I started drinking kombucha, and I think that has to do with it. Well, John, you know I work at Coyote Ugly, right?
That Milwaukee scene. Dude, wait, so what is kombucha? I don't even know what that is.
Kombucha, it's like a fermented tea, and I've never had it before. It looks funny. It's got stuff floating in it, and I can only assume that that's what caused this because, I don't know, if you're listening to this and you know about kombucha more than the fact that it's got stuff floating in it and it's tea, please tell me if that's what caused this awful hangover experience. Basically, I was out all day Saturday, and my weekend was pretty crap because of it.
So that was my bad beats. Did you end up playing in States?
No, I did not. I wasn't going to in the first place, but I definitely wasn't going to with the hangover.
Yeah.
Magic gives me a headache. I don't know about you guys. Do you come home from those long tournaments with a headache?
No. I come home from those tournaments at 3 a.m. in the morning, so.
I always come home and promise I won't play Magic for at least a day. And usually the next day, if I'm not at a shop, I'm drafting on Moto.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So, I'll be honest. Every time I come home from a tournament like that, I ask where the next game of Magic is. So the fact that I now have Moto to just keep on going, perfect. But I not Magic really this weekend. I played like 4 rounds of miniature golf this week because the weather was not garbage. So I got out to enjoy one of my favorite summer pastimes.
Nice.
Yeah, the good thing about miniature golf is you're always going to make it to round 18.
Daryl, let me ask you something. Did you get any hole-in-ones?
I did not get any hole-in-ones. I did not expect any hole-in-ones on the first few rounds of the course. Also, the course was a little wet. We had a couple of rain showers on one day this week, and they hadn't dried up until like the third or fourth round I played.
Right. Yes, the course being wet.
It doesn't help. I'll say that much. But I'm not a great miniature golfer. It's a casual pastime, most definitely.
All right, John, you got anything, Brandon? If you're going to close this out here.
Sure. I guess my bad beat story is today I played a round of Death and Taxes, and by that I mean I actually paid my taxes. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah, please don't die.
No death, just taxes.
Hey, guys, back on here.
Oh, hey, John.
Our internet got reset, so, yeah.
That's cool. Another bad beat story.
Should we start over?
No. Let's take it from the top.
All right. Anyways, that is the end of the podcast, unless, John, you have any non-magic stuff to go over here?
Nah.
Okay. All right, well, let's close out by saying that we have a Twitter. It is card_knock_life. We currently have 9 followers on that. Let's make that 10 by next week. I think that's a goal. And then also we have a website that has got a couple articles on it. I was looking for some more stuff to post on there. If you're interested in submitting to that, you can reach us at cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com or else check out the website, cardknocklifepodcast.com.
One last thing, too. I don't know if this is something we want to consider, but some folks mentioned trying to get the podcast on a RSS feed that wasn't just with MTGCast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Might be something we want to look into because I noticed if you, like, pull it up on iTunes that it has every podcast listed for MTGCast, so you can't just see it individually.
Well, here's some incentive to be our 10th Twitter follower. If you can tweet us how to do that, it will be done.
If you tweet us how to do it, we'll read your bad beat story for free.
Sweet.
Oh, man, we've got infinite of those. We can read as many bad beat stories as we need. I think we've got a source of funding for Shuming's next microphone so that he can return to the podcast once again.
Yes.
We didn't even mention he's out with the flu this week. He's not dead.
We might get the return of our small Asian caballero.
A finance expert. Anyways, that's the end. We're done. You guys done?
Ship it out of here.
All right. Good night.